Welcome to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. Your host, Mono, here to bring you a slice of gaming life from Tokyo. Today, I'm joined by Joshua Goldie, a.k.a. the Nintendo Chronicler, a.k.a. Nantinjex, from Source Gaming to dig into another code recollection, the surprising revival of a long-dormant Nintendo series. We dive into the game's history, seeing, puzzles, and Ashley Smash moveset. And this episode's feature is a big one, as I take you to Yodobashi Camera Shinjuku, a.k.a. Nishiguchi Honten, one of the most iconic and coolest electronic stores in all of Japan. And as always, we'll wrap up with a bit of news. Let's get right into another code recollection with Joshua Goldie. Nintendo's first big title of 2024 is a surprising one, another code recollection, a remake or perhaps reimagining of the long-dormant Nintendo franchise from the 2000s. Joining me today to dig into everything about the game and the franchise's unique place in Nintendo's history is a special guest. So guest, please introduce yourself.
Hello everyone, I am Nantinjex, the Nintendo Chronicler on YouTube. Also, you can just call me Josh for this. I am a YouTuber, the head of Source Gaming, which is another YouTube channel that talks mainly about Smash Brothers and games from Japan. But I have a side channel that's all my own, that's all about Nintendo. Specifically, I try and focus on more of the niche Nintendo stuff. So we've covered Marvelous, Another Treasure Island, Chibi-Robo, Famicom Detective Club, Sudi Hakon, and most recently, I covered Another Code. Because, obviously, the game is coming out, and it's a game I have history with, and I know a lot of people do enjoy. And so I thought, you know what? Someone needs to do a deep dive onto how this game came about. Like, figure out who the developers were, and how they sort of formed, and what led to the creation of Another Code and all that. So it's been a lot on my mind, this franchise, in the last few weeks.
Thanks for joining me. Before we really jump into the remake, I think we need to lay out a lot of groundwork because the history of the franchise is quite fascinating. This is a very broad question, but let's lay out the basics. What is the Another Code franchise?
So the Another Code franchise is a Japanese adventure game, similar to titles like Phoenix Wright, Famicom Detective Club, and the J.B. Harold murder case. Is like a mystery game, but you're not like a police officer or there's no murder happening. It's about a girl who has thought her parents were dead and then finds out one day her father is still alive and has asked her to come to this mysterious location. When she arrives, he's not there. And it's all about sort of trying to find out what's happening with her family, what's happened on this island. You meet a mysterious ghost called D right at the start, and he's also got a story going on. Really, it's just a lot about Ashley, the main character, trying to uncover and unravel her own memories. She keeps having dreams about stuff that she has no memory of. And so there's like this potential amnesia plotline going on in the background, which is also something that D has. So it's about her and D, this ghost boy, trying to regain all of their lost memories and discover the truth about her family and what happened to them 10 years ago or whatever it is in the game. It's very text-heavy. It's written by someone who's very familiar with writing mystery stories and novels.
Did you play these games back in the day, or were they something you discovered later?
No, I've been playing Another Code not since it came out, but I did start with the DS one. I think I must, because the original came out like the same year that the DS launched, at least in Europe. But I didn't pick it up until something like 2008. Like, I think my first exposure to Another Code was probably Super Smash Bros. Brawl.
Right.
Because it has a trophy and stickers for it in there. But then I was going on a DS new like IP spree and playing all sorts of games like Ace Attorney and The World Ends With You. And I picked up Another Code as a part of that and really enjoyed it. And then that got me into Hotel Dusk and then eventually Another Code R, which did release in Europe, which came out in like 2009. I picked that up on launch and played through that as well. So yeah, I'm pretty familiar with both games and Sing's other titles, the Hotel Dusk duology. So I was super excited when this got announced, the recollection back in September.
Yes, listeners, if you're unfamiliar with the games that are actually in this franchise, there's Another Code from 2005, which is called Trace Memory in America. And then another Code R, which is the Wii sequel in 2009, came out in Japan and Europe, but not in America for whatever reason. This franchise is quite emblematic of the DS and Wii era, where Nintendo tried to reach first-time gamers and focused on titles that literally anybody could play. The most famous examples of these are franchises like Wii Fit and Brain Age. What's Another Code's place in this era of gaming?
So whenever I think of Another Code on the Blue Ocean titles that Nintendo has, it's always the game that's told, like, people who weren't gamers, the elderly usually is what I think of, like, people who might be from Gen X or even boomers that never played games before. It's sort of being like, look, you can have stories told to you that are, like, just as good as what you might find in novels. This is basically a book as a playable game. I think the art style, going for slightly more realistic and then this paintbrush type of look, sort of emphasizes that this isn't a kid's game, this is a game for adults, and then it being very narrative heavy, very into the themes and text, that also gets that across as well. That's how I've always viewed Another Code. I actually thought Another Code was part of the Touch Generations line of games.
Right.
And the second one actually is, but only in Europe. Oh. Another Code R was released under that label. But the original actually wasn't at all. But it was in my brain. I was convinced that it was until I looked it up. That's really how Another Code fits in with those Nintendo titles. It really feels like one of these early Blue Ocean games that the company was going for back in the mid-2000s.
Let's dig more into the developer scene. They have a cult fan base, but they're more important in Japanese gaming history than a lot of people imagine. Give us the rundown on Sing's history.
Sing was formed in 1999. Takuya Miyagawa, who was the CEO, and Rika Suzuki, who was the vice president, they met first at a company called Riverhill Soft, which Rika Suzuki helped found. They were big in the PC-88 sector back in the 1980s, making Japanese adventure games. The J.B. Harold Murder series is their most famous because it was the one that came to the West.
Right.
These are effectively very similar to games like Famicom Detective Club. I don't actually know off the top of my head which one came first, but both of those titles owe inspiration to a game made by the Dragon Quest guy. Yuji Horii, he made what people consider the first Japanese adventure game, which only released in Japan, and it's very much sparked Riverhill Soft's whole career. All of their early games, you can tell that they're very inspired by this one. After this point, they started working on J.B. Harold series, then started a few other things. They made an RPG called Burai, which is a very bizarre RPG in that it is mostly text. It is basically, even though it's classified as an RPG, and I think the characters have stats, if you actually would like to look at gameplay of it, it's basically a visual novel. It's a very bizarre take on a JRPG, but apparently it was popular enough to get two sequels. And they also made, like, another game on the Super Nintendo called Princess Minerva. They were very big on the TurboGrafx. They did a lot of porting of other games like Prince of Persia to the TurboGrafx. And I think they worked on a Bomberman game, actually. Basically, they started off as a Japanese adventure series for PCs and slowly moved their way onto consoles and started doing other types of genres. I think the other series they were most well known for was Overblood, which was a survival horror franchise that started the same year as Resident Evil. A few months after it, I think, is when it came out. So it was in development alongside Resident Evil. And they got very similar ideas, except that I'm pretty sure Overblood doesn't have a fixed camera angle. So it's a bit more free roaming. It's not as good as Resident Evil. I think we can probably accept that, given that it's not stuck around. But it was pretty impressive for the time. However, towards the end of the 1990s, the company was mainly focused on bringing titles over rather than making their own games. They were still making Overblood titles, but they weren't making any other of the adventure games that they were doing. And they were instead sort of focused on publishing other companies' games and then making spin-offs in those top franchises. So there's a series called Neverhood, which had two titles on the PS1. And Riverhill were in charge of bringing both of those to Japan. But then they also made their own, like, sports spin-off title for the Neverhood series that they fully developed exclusively and then released on the PS1. And this is the kind of relationship they had with various developers at the time. And I think that's why, now this is me sort of speculating, but I think that's why Miyagawa and Suzuki both jumped ship and left River Hill, because they just weren't being able to bring new experiences to people. They left River Hill, and then about a year later, they founded Sing. And their Sing's MO, the motto that they started with, is that they wanted to provide new experiences to gamers.
Mm.
So I think from that, I get the impression that they weren't happy with the direction that River Hill Soft had gone creatively. And so they went off and founded their own company with the hopes of doing more unique experiences from a creative perspective that they think people would like. So that's how Sing came to be. Now, despite this, I feel like they've mostly done adventure games still,
right. Yes.
Which isn't exactly what I'd call a unique experience.
Hmm.
But that may have been because their first title that they worked for, a game called Glass Rose, did really badly.
Yes. For PS2, correct?
Yes. PS2 game made with Capcom. They worked together with Capcom on it. And it's basically a point-and-click adventure game, but in full 3D. And it's just apparently not good. I've never played it. I've only read reviews and looked at footage for it. It did come out in Europe, but it didn't come out in America. And yeah, the impressions I got is that the story is not good. The gameplay felt super archaic. It's just wasn't a fun time all around, which I think sort of forced Sing's hand and made them decide to lean back into what they knew they had experience with making, which is how Another Code, their second game, came to be. Just a traditional Japanese adventure game, but one that would take full advantage of the new hardware it was on, which was the Nintendo DS.
Hmm. For me, I'm mostly familiar with Sing because of Hotel Dusk on the DS, which is another adventure-style game that heavily uses the DS features. Would you say you're an Another Code guy or a Hotel Dusk type of guy?
Definitely a Hotel Dusk type of guy. Hotel Dusk might be Sing's magnum opus.
Yes.
It's a really good game. And part of the hype of seeing Another Code come back is that if it does well, a Hotel Dusk duology remake is potentially on the horizon as well. Like, I love Another Code. I really like Ashley as a protagonist just as much as I like Kyle Hyde. But I think the story in Hotel Dusk and The Last Window, which is definitely more of a traditional mystery adventure game, is just a lot stronger than what Another Code does. Like, I think the story in Another Code is good, but I find the story in the Hotel Dusk series slightly more intriguing. And that keeps me more captivated, I think, on it.
For Another Code, the original game sold above expectations despite mixed reviews in the West, and it has a pretty solid cult following all these years later. Why do you think the franchise developed this type of fan base?
So, I think that it's being one of the first easily accessible games of its type in the West definitely helped with this. So, the Japanese adventure, as the name of the genre implies, is very Japanese-based. There are tons of games in this series over there. It's been a cult thing since, like, the 1980s. But because of a long-standing belief that Westerners wouldn't like story-based games, they never released any of them in the West. They were either only fan-translated games or were very experimental. We're going to try and see if this works, usually, like, on PCs or maybe the PS1. But they never usually paid off. Point-and-click adventure games were big, like Secret of Monkey Island, and that's probably why they considered Glass Rose to be brought over. But Another Code is more like a traditional Japanese adventure game in that you're clicking on things and there's a lot of text and it's slightly less comedic focused. Like, I think that's where point-and-click adventure games sort of shine, because they were very tongue-in-cheek comedy with little bites of dialogue here and there, whereas Another Code is like paragraphs and text. It's like reading a book.
Yeah.
Like, most people would consider it a visual novel, but technically that's not correct. But I think that Another Code was the first one of its type to come out and was an early DS title when the DS was like, everyone was thinking it was the coolest thing, this machine with two screens. And I think these two things together allowed it to find a lot more success than it might otherwise have done, had it just been released like halfway through the DS's life cycle. Like, Another Code released before Ace Attorney came over here. And those two games have very similar sales. makes me believe that another code kind of came out, an early DS title pushed by Nintendo, so it was a first-party title. This all got more eyes on a game that otherwise would probably have gone ignored outside of very niche circles, and then that catapulted that genre over in the West and started getting people who played that started looking for other games of its type, and then that's how people got into Ace Attorney, and then from that realized how great the genre can be. I do think, not to downplay another code, but I do think the Ace Attorney franchise is the better game here. But I think from that point on, people, that's helped everyone look at the Another Code, the first Another Code, with like very, I don't want to say rose-tinted glasses, because that would make it sound like it was bad and people were just nostalgic for it. I think that made people really appreciate Another Code, the first game. And that just helped it stay active in people's minds. It's kind of like Golden Sun on the Game Boy Advance, where it's one of these franchises that people grew up with that were really early in their console lifespan. And so people just always associate the console with that franchise.
Right.
And so that's just kept it in people's minds. When people think of the DS, they think of Another Code. When people who think of visual novels or Japanese adventure games, Another Code is one of the ones that probably comes to mind. And I think all of this has allowed it to still kind of exist, even when it wasn't getting any games. Especially in America, where they only got Trace Memory.
Yes.
Obviously, in Europe, we got two games in the series, but because I think America only got Trace Memory, and because there was this mysterious second game that they never got access to, I think that made the franchise as well relevant on the Nintendo fan online scene. People were like, just, ooh, we can't have this second game, but I remember the first game and I really liked it, and so I really want to play the second game at some point, and I hope Nintendo brings it over at some point. This keeps a franchise alive, like all the talk about it online, even after there's been no games.
Well, the franchise is alive now because September 2023, the Nintendo Direct, Another Code Recollection, a remake of both games, was revealed, and they said that it's going to come out in January. What was your immediate reaction to seeing that Nintendo was bringing back this franchise after 15 years?
I was popping off. I think we, on Source Gaming, we tend to live stream all our reactions to Nintendo Directs, and you can like see my reaction on that stream where I'm like, in disbelief that another code was going to be coming back. Like, you know, sometimes you hear video game rumors and stuff, and it kind of dilutes your reaction to when announcements happen. But Another Code, I hadn't heard anything about. No one was talking about it. I had no expectations for it to be there. So when it did show up, I was flabbergasted. It was my announcement of that September Direct. That Direct had Paper Mario in it, right. Like the best Paper Mario. But who cares about that? Another Code, is it?
I, too, was quite surprised. Out of all the franchises to bring back, this one didn't seem likely at all, but you could say that the Famicom Detective Club remakes sort of foreshadowed it. This game is co-developed with Arc System Works of Guilty Gear fame, where many X-Sing members ended up. The game staff consists of pretty much all the major players from the original game, and Rika Suzuki does return as a writer. One thing that immediately caught my attention is that instead of it being two distinct games that you pick from the menu, like most collections, they've remixed it into one continuous adventure. For example, you can't start Another Code R from the beginning. What did you think about this decision to essentially meld both titles into one game?
Yeah, I think that's probably the smartest choice. When I was playing the demo, I had this thought, and I was like, yeah, it wouldn't make any sense for them to let you play Another Code R from the start. Because that game very much assumes that you've played the first Another Code, and so has no problem with, like, immediately spoiling it. Like, there is a major spoiler for the first Another Code within the first hour of Another Code R. It's very much a sequel and a follow-on. So I think from a narrative perspective, you would be ruining the first game if you went and played the second game first. And the developers obviously know this. So their solution is to just not allow the player to do that and just have it be one continuous narrative. And I think that makes a lot of sense. I think that's a very smart thing to do because you can very easily transition from one to the other. I feel like, so obviously, again, I've not played the remakes yet, but the original Another Code actually had slightly altered endings, depending on how much progress you made in the game.
Oh.
And I'm curious whether or not Another Code Recollections kept that or not. I actually didn't get the best ending of Another Code when I first played it back in the DS, because you have to do every single puzzle and find every single, like, clue. Hmm. And I never solved the stamp puzzle, the infamous close the DS and open it again puzzle. So I actually didn't get the best ending, which is how I'm aware that there are multiple endings. But I'm assuming Recollections won't do that because it's one continuous narrative. They'll want it to transition immediately from the first to the second game.
Yeah, I do kind of wonder if there are Americans who recently played Trace Memory, or at least freshen their memory, and they kind of wanted to jump to the second game, but now they got to go through the entire first game again. And I can't really think of another game that's done this. Maybe Fire Emblem 3, which has a remake of the first game that led into new content. But here they've taken two existing games and made them one. And this also seems a bit unorthodox for Nintendo, who has put out very straightforward remakes recently. And a lot of people are saying that this is a remake, but perhaps reimagining is more apt. And even many of the puzzles are completely different than what they were in the original game. What are your thoughts on these changes, and why do you think they drastically changed many of the elements of the game?
Yeah, this was something that I noticed when I was playing the demo. When I was making my video, I obviously went through the beginning, at least, of Another Code on the DS several times, and on Trace Memory, because Trace Memory has a slightly different localization. So when I was playing the demo, I noticed immediately all the changes they'd made to Chapter 1.
Mm.
Like the fact that you don't start on the boat and start in the forest for this little tutorial section.
Right.
In the original game, when Ashley goes to try and find Jessica, she comes across a bridge that then opens up, and the puzzle is you have to solve how to get the drawbridge down so that Ashley can cross. But that's been replaced in this game with a big gate and a stool that has a pair of keys hidden underneath it. And like you see the captain leave, which you don't see in the original game. Like, you just leave and then you never go back. So you just assume that he leaves. So like, they've made a lot of changes here, some of it for narrative purposes, and then I think others just because of the new hardware. So when they made the first Another Code, and when they made Another Code R, one of the big things that they wanted to do was make all the puzzles be relevant to the system itself.
Yeah.
And try and utilize as many of the key features of the DS and the Wii as possible. That's obviously... that means that a lot of those puzzles really require the hardware that those systems have, which the Switch doesn't have. You can potentially get the motion control stuff. I mean, the Switch version does have motion control puzzles, which are a bit finicky from what I played in the demo. But they're not like the same type of puzzles that Another Code R had. That had a lot of pointer puzzles and like very subtle motion control ones, because the motion control on the Wii is just ever so slightly better than it is on the Switch, because it's obviously designed more with that. It's not just using a typical gyro like the Joy-Cons do. And so I think it was a necessity for them to have to replace all the puzzles and redo them. And if that's the case, do you have to add context for puzzles? This isn't like Professor Layton, where you click on something and he goes, I think this reminds me of a puzzle, and you get something that's only partially related to what's happened. The puzzles within Another Code are contextual to the events that are going around in the story, which means that if they're changing the puzzles, they're going to have to slightly alter the way the story develops. And then I think just also having the advantage of modern hardware and new engine allows them to tell the story in more dramatic and realistic ways. These aren't just 2D art on the top screen with occasionally changing expressions. They can have Ashley like moving around. They can have cuts between things where Ashley's now sitting down and waiting for Jessica to get back. In the original game, when Jessica leaves, it just immediately transitions to her talking to the captain. Whereas in the remake, it's like Jessica leaves, then Ashley has like a sort of thought, then there's a fade to black, and then it cuts to her sitting down looking mopey on the side of the dock. Like, it adds a lot of little extra things to sort of make Ashley's character and the story itself pop out more. And I think it's this sort of change in hardware and this advancement in technology that's affected the way that they're telling the narrative with all these little changes here and there.
I'm about halfway through the first game, and so far the puzzles really haven't revolved around the Switch's features. There is a motion control puzzle, but there aren't any that revolve around HD Rumble or the IR camera, Would you have preferred them to lean more into the Switch's unique functions when it comes to puzzle solving, or do you think there's an advantage to having it mostly just be button controls?
I would have liked a puzzle around the IR camera and HD rumble, at least one. Like we brought up with the stamp puzzle on DS, that's the only puzzle that requires you to close the DS and open it up again, but that makes it really unique. So I would like to see a puzzle show up at some point that uses the IR camera. Like WarioWare Move It has a mini game where you have to do like rock, paper, scissors. There's one where you have to put your hands up for 2, 3, or 4 to solve a math puzzle. And something like that could have worked very well in another code where you use the IR camera to like show something on your hands or whatever to have a puzzle. But now that I'm thinking about it, they probably acknowledge that a lot of people play with pro controllers. So they probably had to design the game around using the pro controller as well, which doesn't have an IR camera. But I think because of that, they probably couldn't do that. Although I would still have liked them to use the unique features of the Switch a bit more. Maybe they were trying to avoid issues like, so another code R has a pretty funny puzzle towards the end of the game that requires the use of the nunchuck. And it's the only puzzle that requires the use of the nunchuck. This stands out because the game even tells you that it can be played with just a single Wii remote. It was one of the big draws of the game that you could play it all with just one hand and a single Wii remote. And then out of nowhere towards the end, it's like, okay, actually, no, you need a nunchuck now. Plug that in, please. And that's like, I think that gets brought up quite a lot when people look back at another code R, sort of post, like, humorously. I think they probably wanted to avoid that problem again. So they probably decided to, whatever the pro controller can do, that's how we're going to have to design puzzles for. But that is a shame, thinking about it a bit more. I would like him to have interesting puzzles that use the Joy-Con, because technically everyone has a Joy-Con, even if you prefer using the pro controller.
Yeah.
So they could have enforced it, but oh well.
Some other big changes. The original game had a top-down view on the bottom screen, with the top screen being an illustration of the room. But now you control Ashley in third person, with some first-person segments. The graphics also kind of stray away from the comic book sketchy style of the original game into cell shading with a soft color palette. What are your thoughts on the presentation of the game so far?
I really like the presentation of the game. I think one of the most interesting things when I was researching the original Other Code was that Kanasaki, who is the art director, and he was the director of the original game as well, wanted the game to be played from a three-quarter perspective, something like The Legend of Zelda.
Yeah.
The old Legend of Zelda, I should say. The reason they went with top-down was because they thought that new players wouldn't be used to 3D, would struggle to get used to playing in 3D. So having something that was top-down would be easier to understand, especially if you're then using the DS to move Ashley around, which is how you walked around in that game. But now that gaming has advanced so far, and 3D is the norm, most people are used to it. And because of that, I think they could finally go for something that was a bit more dynamic, like Kanasaki might have originally envisioned. Every time I think of this game, it feels like it's potentially more in line with that original vision they had when first pitching the game than the one we actually got on the DS. As for the cell shading, I think it's a smart move for this, for another code at least. It still uses 2D art for facial expressions, which is a big thing for Kanasaki. It uses 2D art for background as well. Like, they try and use 2D actual hand-drawn art where possible, but to have that fit a lot nicer, the cell shading, I think, is better. So if you compare it to another code R, the other 3D game they made, I think the models in this game look a lot nicer and look a lot closer to what the original art style was than they do in another code R, which also uses 2D art for facial animations and stuff, but I don't think it blends as well with the models than it does here with how they've handled the cell shading in this game. I think it makes Ashley far more expressive than she is in another code R. So I think it was the right choice. It makes me curious, though, what they'll do if they do remake Hotel Dusk, because that game has a very unique 2D hand-drawn art style, and that's something I'm not quite sure you can easily replicate in 3D.
Yeah, I agree. I'm definitely hoping for a Hotel Dusk collection, but I think, at least for that game, it's more important to kind of keep that art consistent, not change it up so much. But I do really love how Another Code Recollection looks. The cell shading looks fantastic. And if you kind of think about it, this might be one of the best looking visual novels or best looking point and click adventure games, at least recently. It has this really amazing art style. And there's definitely put a lot of effort into it that you wouldn't really expect. They could have made a pretty straightforward remake, maybe even keep the same perspective, but they're totally reimagining the game.
You can tell there's a lot of love being put into this. I don't think this is a very high budget game. Like, there's a lot of areas within the animation and the textures where I can tell it is very clearly slightly low quality stuff.
Right.
But I know this isn't a high budget game, and I could tell how much love they've actually put into it to make everything else, like the character models and all that, look as impressive as they are. You can tell they really put their all into this. I think they must have realized this is their chance to bring another code back, because I always got the impression that Sing really loved the Another Code franchise. It was their, like, Mario, basically. it's the thing they're most well known for. And I think a lot of the people at Sing like Ashley. Ashley's like their favorite character, with Kyle being like the close second. And so they were very upset when Sing eventually went bankrupt, because it meant that they weren't going to be able to do anything with this series again. Which is why you have like Kanasaki basically drawing Ashley fan art over the last decade and answering any comments that people, or any questions that people had for him on social media about what happened to Ashley or Kyle or anything like that. So they clearly love this series. So getting the chance to work on a new game, I think they put their A game into it.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying the game so far. One thing that I've noticed is that there is a pretty heavy focus on the story. And there are, of course, many, many puzzles, but I would say the story definitely takes precedence over just going through a puzzle gauntlet. Are the original Another Code games similar to this, where it's more story heavy, or is it a bit more balanced between story and puzzles?
Yeah, I'd say so. I'd say the original is very story heavy. Like, there's a reason that some people consider games like this visual novels rather than point and click adventure games. That's just a way that a lot of Japanese adventure games are. Again, comparing it to something like Ace Attorney, the investigation sections on that are always just click something and then read all the dialogue that happens. I think that's the difference between Western adventure games and Japanese adventure games. The Western ones tend to focus a lot more on the puzzles and where you would use one item with another, whereas the Japanese adventure games tend to be focused a lot more on the text. And what you're really looking for is whatever is the next flag to activate that next text, which is often either clicking on something, or in another code's case, actually having a puzzle to solve, which was becoming more of a trend at the time that the original Another Code came out, to make those sort of games a bit more interactive and try and appeal to new fans who don't want to just read a book. But yeah, I would say the original Another Code is also very text heavy, with only a few puzzles actually happening throughout.
Yeah, neither of us are super far into the game, so it's hard to outright recommend. But as someone with experience with the franchise, what is your expectation for a recollection?
I was very impressed with the demo. I think outside of the slightly janky motion control puzzle that happens early on, when I was playing it with two Joy-Cons free, I was just struggling. And then when I put them into the Joy-Con holder, it was a bit better, but it's not ideal. Like, I don't know how many motion control puzzles are in this game, but I'm hoping not many.
I've only encountered that one so far. I'm not super deep into it, but that's the only one. So that one kind of stands out.
Another Code R might potentially have more, because obviously the original Wii game used motion controls a lot. But for now, I'm fine if they've toned it down on this. I've been impressed with everything from the art style to the voice direction to the way the story has progressed. I mean, it's very similar to the original, just with slight changes here and there. And I'm kind of impressed with Ashley as a character herself in this one. A big problem with the original Another Code is, at least the first Another Code, is that Ashley comes off as kind of plain. Trace Memory's a bit different. They actually tried to spice up the dialogue in Trace Memory to make Ashley have a bit of a stronger personality. But the original Ashley in the first Another Code, I think it's because of the lack of voice acting and stuff. Like, you can tell in scenes where she's sort of meant to be upset, but because it's not voiced and it's just text, and the way Ashley's expression is, like, it's not very over-exaggerated, it's kind of subdued, you don't really get it across. Whereas in the remake, you do, because they're fully voiced. The voice can do a lot of carrying, and the full animations can also do that. And I think that makes Ashley feel more dynamic as a character, which is something that Another Code R was better at doing than the original Another Code, because it also could use 3D models. And I think that's going to make the story of Another Code in Recollection just that more pronounced and that more impactful for anyone who's playing it.
Yeah, this is my first real experience with the game, and the thing that really sets it apart from other adventure games is that it does have a very distinct atmosphere where it's a bit laid back, but also still pretty mysterious. You're exploring this early 20th century house, so there's a lot of really interesting visual elements, and the contrast between, you have a, it's called a DAS, which looks like maybe the Switch 2. It's a very futuristic device. So it is a really interesting contrast between this really advanced tablet that you have, and you can take photos and whatnot, and also this 19th century decor. And the story is pretty interesting so far, so I definitely want to keep with it and see what other puzzles they have in store. All the puzzles have mostly been button-related, and there are some clever ones in there where you have to overlay two images on top of each other. I'm not sure if that was in the original game, but they definitely have a lot of different ideas for puzzles. So that's something I'm looking forward to as I progress in the game. And final question, if the protagonist, Ashley Mizuki Robbins, becomes a playable character in Smash Brothers, what should her moveset be?
She definitely needs to have a guitar in her moveset, because that's a big thing in Another Code R. She's a musician. She plays guitar. Need to be able to use the DAS to take photographs. Like, flash, like, stun with that. Maybe have D in there in some way. Use him as, like, a puppet-type character, kind of like Rosalina and Luma, something like that. I don't know. I think maybe using any of the items that Ashley finds throughout the game and just incorporating them into the moveset would probably be the way to go. And then, I guess, sort of showing her being out of her element, given that this is a fighting game with weird, wacky characters everywhere, and she's a normal 14/16-year-old girl, depending on which game version of her you want to go for. So maybe having her dash attack has her trip over herself or something, or like close her eyes and just sort of shoulder bash into somebody.
Maybe the final smash could be the stamp puzzle from the original game.
Yeah, that'd be pretty good, actually.
All right, so those were our early impressions on Another Code Recollection and a primer on the franchise as a whole. So Joshua, where can people find you?
Yeah, so I have two YouTube channels. The Nintendo Chronicler is my personal one. That is where the Another Code video is, which I would obviously go recommend watching after this for more information about the franchise. The other channel is Source Gaming, which is a bit more Super Smash Brothers focused, a bit more general news orientated. Do that with a team of people. Those are the two main places to see content. Otherwise, Twitter is where I'm usually the most active. Handle is at Mr. Nintendo. I'm also on Blue Sky, just under Nantengex, if anyone uses that. Those are probably the best places to find me. So yeah, go there and subscribe on YouTube, please.
Great, and the links to everything will be in the podcast description, so check it out. I'll also directly link the video you made for Another Code for those who want to dig more into the franchise. So Joshua, once again, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure to chat.
This episode's feature is one I've wanted to do for a long time, Yodobashi Camera Shinjuku. Technically, there are multiple Yodobashi cameras in Shinjuku, but I'm specifically talking about the most iconic location, Nichiguchi Honten or Shinjuku Nichiguchi. But for SEO purposes and for the sake of understanding, let's just call it the Shinjuku one. I did think about just covering all the Yodobashi cameras in one podcast segment, but I feel this branch is so interesting that it deserves its own episode, and I want to do different segments on Yodobashi cameras in other parts of Tokyo, like the one in Ueno, and definitely the one in Akihabara. Your first question might be, what on earth is Yodobashi Camera? It's a chain of massive electronic stores all over Japan. I assumed it was fairly prominent, but believe it or not, there are only 24 locations in Japan, with 8 of them in Tokyo. And 3 of those are in Shinjuku. As someone who lives in Tokyo, I just assumed they were all over the place because I see them often, but nope, they really are localized in the capital. The first store opened up in 1975. Where? Shinjuku Nishiguchi, the place I'm going to talk about today. As you can guess, it's not too far from the west exit, aka Nishiguchi, of Shinjuku Station. In fact, Yodobashi Camera's MO when they first started opening stores was to deliberately get them as close to the station as possible. They also innovated in other areas, such as having big displays that you can see from outside of the store. As the name suggests, they initially only sold cameras, but they expanded into other electronics and hobby items. I'm not going to talk about cameras, sorry, but I will say that outside their camera building, they often have very cool displays, like a map of recommended photo spots for fall leaves around Tokyo, so it is quite useful, ironically. Alright, so it's the first store, but what's so special about it? First of all, it's fairly close to my home, so I do have some attachment to it because it's one of my go-to spots on a lazy Sunday when I don't have any other plans. But for others, what really stands out most is its incredible design and layout. When you think of electronic stores in the West, or even big department stores in Japan, you think of just a big box with all the stuff jammed inside. But their flagship Shinjuku store isn't just one building, but 13 different buildings, all laid out like a city block. Each building focuses on a different theme, and they all end with the Japanese suffix kan, which means building or structure, so you're going to hear that often. You've got the smartphone kan, you've got the camera kan, the phone kan, the travel goods kan, and so on. I'm not going to give a thorough breakdown on all of them because there are really only three you should pay attention to if you're a gaming aficionado. The toy con, the hobby con, and of course, the game con. When you emerge from Shinjuku Station's west exit, you'll easily spot the place even from hundreds of yards out. It was built in the 70s, and it still looks like it. Of course, at the time, it was very modern looking, but now it kind of resembles retrofuturism a bit. The first building you'll spot is the multimedia con with this huge red neon sign that says Yorobashi Camera. Now, by neon, I don't mean some LCD screen with a video playing. I'm talking pipes that use actual neon gas. I'm trying to think if this is the most neon piping I've ever seen. Normally, it's reserved to beer advertisements in pubs. But if you go at night, the place looks spectacular and ripped right out of the Showa era or the bubble era of Japan. Another Yorobashi Camera in the area also has some neon signage, but the original location has them beat. And if you go in winter, there will often be lights strung up on the trees nearby, so it makes for a fantastic photo op. Who knew that taking a picture of the outside of an electronics store would make for prime Instagram material? The multimedia con is also lined with hundreds of gacha machines. These can be hard to peruse since they're wrapped all around the building side by side and likely aren't in any specific order. Now, right across from the multimedia con is a bench area adorned with Pokeballs right in front of a huge Pokemon wall mural. I often see tons of people sitting here playing Pokemon Go, even today. If you need a free place to sit down in the middle of Shinjuku, it comes highly recommended. All the cons are only about a few floors. Since there are multiple buildings spread out, there's no need for some gigantic 15-story structure. But you'd be surprised about how deceptively large some of them can be. There's plenty of maps all over the buildings and floor plans for each one, so it's pretty easy to find what you want, even though everything is spread out. But I love just weaving in and out of the buildings. They're almost like an open floor space, so you almost never need to actually pull open a door. It's very easy to just take shortcuts by crossing through. But if you're only here for gaming stuff, fortunately, everything is grouped together pretty closely. After you pass the massive multimedia building, you take two rides, and then that's where you want to hang out. The first thing that'll catch your eye is a very small Gigo arcade. The first floor is only crane games, but I always pop by here anytime I visit this Yorobashi Camera. I want a giant Kirby plushie here, so maybe it is a lucky location. And when you exit the arcade and go straight near the outskirts of the complex, you'll find the three most fun buildings all grouped together, the Toy Con, the Game Con, and the Hobby Con. I guess we should start with the Game Con. The outside is immediately eye-catching. On the right side of the door are typically huge Nintendo ads, and on the left are for PlayStation. Recently, I've also seen demo booths set up here. On the outside, you'll often see standees you might not see anywhere else. There was a huge Link one right before Tears of the Kingdom's launch, and one of my favorites was one where you voted for the upcoming Splatfest. This was the deep cut themed one where you voted for which member of the trio you liked the best. The display had three columns and multicolored stickers where you could place your vote of who you wanted to win via the sticker. Needless to say, Shiver was comfortably in the lead, but what a creative and interactive way to advertise what is essentially a limited event in a game. Step inside and you'll find a very compact but very visually stimulating game store. At the entrance, you'll notice a lot of free pamphlets, which I featured on a previous episode, and typically the biggest game launch will be on this display table with a TV. The right side of the store is the Switch section, with the left side being PlayStation, and some peripherals and Xbox and other stuff are kind of scattered about. I mostly hang out in the Nintendo section. It's small, but it has pretty much everything you need. There are elaborately decorated aisles for new releases and special sections like ones dedicated to Mario games. And hanging from the rafters, banners of the latest Nintendo games, often with exclusive art or promo material that I haven't seen published online. Between each of the aisles are these vertical TVs that showcase game trailers. It's got the Switch logo on the top third, then the trailer, then the game key art. I don't know who needs a vertical TV outside of Yodobashi Camera, but they do draw your attention. Below the TVs are often pre-order boxes for new games. Anytime there's a Nintendo Direct, if you go a day or two later, you can almost certainly find the physical pre-order boxes there, along with some promo material. Even when they changed Peach's face in Showtime, it was only a matter of days before all the pre-order boxes had her new face. I buy my games digitally, so I don't really need to go to Yodobashi Camera to buy games, but I have picked up some Amiibos and Joy-Cons here before. The Shinjuku branch isn't going to have anything that's not at the other stores, but it has a thorough inventory despite its small floor space. The PlayStation and Xbox sessions are much smaller by comparison, but they do have some nicely decorated game displays and the huge TVs showing off trailers. In the middle of the store is a huge column of eShop cards, and you can find many download cards here for games that came out years ago. I'm pretty sure if you go today, you could probably find a download card for Breath of the Wild or Captain Toad, so if you're collecting those, check out this store. Oh, and in the back of the store, there's a good selection of Japanese gaming magazines. Here's where you can pick up the latest Famitsu or Nintendo Dream. While it's nowhere near as big as most game stores, I just love how in-your-face it is with all the decorations, and what you need is right in front of you without having to comb through the aisles. It's small, but smartly designed. Now, while the game store is only one floor, the building has a second and third floor dedicated to models like Gunpla and trains and whatnot. Getting there is a little odd because the staircase is kind of between two buildings and not inside the game store itself. I haven't really seen any gaming-related stuff on the other floors, but there might be some figures or whatnot. Now, after the game store, right across from that is the Toy-Con. It's about six floors, with each floor focusing on a different type of toy. Floor one is Lego, with some other building toys. There's a baby floor, one for board games, one for outdoors toys, and so on. The only really big game-related thing here are the Pokemon toys on the first floor. So if you collect Monkore or whatever, this is where you can find them. I don't have a lot of these plastic Pokemon figures, but every time I come here, I think, should I just buy every Pokemon I've ever liked? Also, in the staircase of the Toy-Con, they often have gaming advertisements, and I don't know if they've changed it recently, but for a long time, they had the Miis there. Yes, from the Wii and DS era. Even into the Switch era, you could see the staircase just adorned with Miis. Now, right outside the Toy-Con, you'll likely spot one of the more iconic pieces of merch at Yodobashi Camera, a wide-eyed monkey clanging cymbals. This is, without a doubt, always right in front of the store, inviting you inside with its incessant banging. I honestly don't know the lore of the monkey, but it seems to be produced by Yodobashi itself, and is a pricey 5,000 yen. But I kind of want one because it's just such a strangely retro and outdated toy to sell right next to all the modern ones. Do people actually buy the monkey? Does an 8-year-old see this and say, listen, for the same price you could buy me a video game or a Lego set, but you gotta get me the monkey? Final step is right next to the game store and across from the Toy-Con, the ambiguously named Hobby-Con. While the Toy-Con is geared towards little kids, the Hobby-Con focuses more on plushies, which I guess are also for little kids, but also more adult-oriented collectibles. Outside the doors is a massive wall with giant plushies, mostly from video games like Pokemon, Mario, and Dragon Quest. Again, this is another great photo op. The inside is very narrow, kind of like a long rectangle. Flanking the doors, you'll see Dragon Quest merch and stuff from Fangamer for overseas games like Undertale and Hollow Knight. But this Fangamer merch is the same as the stuff in the States, so you don't really need to look at it if you are from America. But straight ahead is Plushie Paradise, two massive aisles completely covered in plushies. The left has mostly Pokemon, and the right is mostly Mario. I'm going to level with you, the prices here are higher than a place like Nintendo Tokyo or the Pokemon Center. But if you're in the area and don't plan on going there, it at least has a pretty comprehensive inventory. Pretty much every Mario plushie that exists is here, and there are dozens of Pokemon ones, and I'm not just talking about Pikachu. As you progress further down the aisle, you'll see other Nintendo plushies like Pikmin, Kirby, Splatoon, and yes, they even have some Fire Emblem ones. In the back of the store is the trading card game wall. If you're here for Pokemon cards, well, you're probably out of luck. There's a massive issue with buying cards all over Japan, even today, and for certain sets, Yodobashi requires you to sign up for their credit card to buy booster packs. I'm serious here. And even if you get the credit card, you don't get infinite booster packs. There's still a limit. I've heard stories of people who just signed up for the card and then never used it, but signing up for a credit card to get some booster packs is a bit too much, even for me. The back also has a lot of the blind box figures, often made from Remint. There's a ton of Pokemon and Kirby-themed ones here, so keep an eye out for them. The wall on the right also has Metacom toys, which are these well-made plastic figurines at affordable prices. There are some really awesome Nintendo Metacom toys. I own a Mario and Luigi one from the original arcade game, but ironically, I don't think I've seen any of the Nintendo Metacom toys here, despite having a huge wall of them. As you creep toward the register, there's a few smaller aisles of other merch, mostly these plastic standees that have become really popular these past few years. If you don't know what these are, they're basically just pieces of plastic with art printed on them. I've seen these plastic standees for Fire Emblem Engage, Nikkei, and a lot of other gacha games. Again, these are just plastic standees, but if you want merch from those games, this is all you've got. Now, my tip for shopping here, if you live in Japan, it's absolutely worth getting a point card. All your purchases will add up, and you can get some discounts eventually. By default, they would just add points to your card and never ask you to use them, so you need to very specifically inquire about your balance and say you want to use your points. The clerks are almost certainly trained to just scan your card and get you out of the store, so if you want to use those points, you need to make it clear. And I'm not sure if I'm confusing this with Bit Camera, but I do think the points expire eventually, so don't think you're going to be saving up for a PS6. A good rule I have is to hit $20 worth of points and then use them right then and there. So that's Yodobashi Camera Shinjuku, aka Nishiguchi Honten. I think I touched on everything. Oh, there is a book off in walking distance if you want to check that out. But yeah, unrelated to Yodobashi. On the surface, it's just a game store, albeit one with a very distinct aesthetic and unique floor plan. But I always love going here. It feels oddly nostalgic, even though I didn't grow up in Japan. I often swing by Yodobashi on Sunday afternoons if I have no plan, and it does remind me of going to Best Buy as a kid, hoping I could get a game right before the weekend winded down and I gotta go back to reality once Monday hit. Would I recommend going here as a tourist? I mean, there's a ton to do in Shinjuku, and it's kind of on the opposite side of something like Kabukicho, but still very walkable. If you don't plan on scouring all the Bit Cameras or other huge department stores, the Shinjuku Yodobashi certainly has its appeal with its more economical interiors and awesome exterior that is perfect for photos. And it's totally worth swinging by for photos at night around wintertime. If you're in the area, I think it's worth popping by for some retro Showa goodness and more plushies than you can count. That's it for the feature. Now for the news. News, news. There's been quite a lot, but the biggest news is that mini Mario plushies from Mario vs. Donkey Kong are coming to Japan starting from February 17th. There are three sizes priced at 2,200, 3,300, and 4,400 yen from smallest to biggest. Smallest is on a keychain, but you can just pull that right off. I was hoping we would get an amiibo, but a plushie is close enough. That said, normally Sané handles the Nintendo plushies, but these are being handled by the company called Epoch. They normally produce a lot of other Mario toys like the board games and the plastic figures. Sané already has a lot of other plushies on the docket for this year, so maybe Epoch is there to lighten the load a bit. But February 17th, write it down on your calendars. Let's spin up the rumor mill a bit. Are we on the verge of a Zelda theme park attraction announcement? User Guardtooth on Femaboards spotted in a promo video for Universal Studio Orlando's Epic Universe both Shigeru Miyamoto and Eiji Aonuma. They're decked out in construction gear with a lot of other people looking at something. This is a truly blink and you'll miss it moment. Even if you know what to look for, it flies by so fast that it's amazing anyone noticed it. The video has now been removed, so it was clearly a big no-no to show them in that capacity. Especially Aonuma. We already know Mario and DK attractions are coming to Orlando, but why would Aonuma be there at all? If you want to be like me and jump to conclusions, perhaps we are on the cusp of a Zelda ride announcement later this year. There have been rumors that there is supposed to be some sort of boat ride themed after Zelda, but those may have just been initial plans and the final ride might be totally different. But it's clear that Universal and Nintendo have at least laid the groundwork for a Zelda ride. There's also been rumors of a Pokemon and Luigi's Mansion attraction at Universal Studios Japan, which is really exciting. If it was up to me, I'd make the whole park just Nintendo attractions, but I do understand that not everyone is into Nintendo, and you can't really make half the park Nintendo stuff. But Mario, DK, Zelda, that's not a bad combo. I do think a Splatoon attraction has a ton of potential, but maybe that's Japan only. And speaking of Splatoon, the Side Order DLC got a short trailer and a date, February 22nd. This is much earlier than I expected. I was thinking April or May. Not a whole lot of new info from the trailer, but it does hint at Side Order maybe being a simulation with the Matrix Code aesthetic. Or maybe the whole world of Splatoon is indeed just a program. This is my most anticipated announced title of 2024 because I love Splatoon 3 and Octo was one of the best DLC that Nintendo ever put out, so I do have high expectations for this one. Trying not to get myself too hyped up, but I do think it might shock a lot of people. Put it on your radar right now. The online services for 3DS and Wii U will cease on April 8th. You can still use the Pokebank and Pokemon Transporter, but come on, you should have used that years ago when Sword and Shield came out. The online services closing, pretty sad. In 5 years, will the Switch Online shut down? I mean, it took 12 years for the Wii U online services to be shuttered, and in 5 years, Switch will be 12. Think about it. But probably not. I'm trying to think of some good last-minute recommendations. Maybe you could jump back into Splatoon 1 for a few matches, or see if anyone wants to battle you in XY. I think most have moved on, but it's sad to see that this era of gaming is basically done. It wasn't Nintendo's peak, but it still had a lot of classic games, and I have many fond memories. So, farewell Wii U and 3DS. Last bit of news, going back to the rumor mill, Omdia, which is a research analyst firm, recently said that the Nintendo Switch 2, or whatever it's called, will have an 8-inch LCD screen. This is about 1 inch bigger than the Nintendo Switch OLED. And yes, this sounds like it might be pretty hefty. The Steam Deck is already a borderline Leviathan, so I think people are okay with these larger pieces of hardware, but they don't really seem that travel friendly. I wonder if they will have different SKUs at launch, maybe a smaller and a bigger one, but if it does have a PS4 level of power, well, it's really hard to jam that into a tablet. I see a lot of people complain about the LCD screens, and yeah, it is disappointing to go from OLED to LCD, especially considering how great the Switch OLED screen is, but LCD doesn't mean it's just inherently worse. The Analog Pocket has an LCD screen, and everyone agrees that it looks absolutely beautiful. So if it's bright enough and the colors pop enough, I think a lot of people won't notice, especially with this giant screen. As someone who plays the Switch in handheld mode a lot of the time, honestly, the bigger the better. Okay, time's up. Thanks as always for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite app. Leave a 5-star review as well. It really helps with visibility. The podcast is also available on YouTube, so like and subscribe there as well. I'm on Twitter, Threads, Blue Sky, Instagram. Just search for Tokyo Game Life or find the links in the podcast description. If you like the podcast, be sure to share it with your friends and on social media. If there's anything you want to talk about or cover, don't be shy. Just message me on Twitter. The next episode will be on February 11th. See you next time. Matane!